I think the importance of Biavi was highlighted during the pandemic, and people did know that already. So really appreciate that. I had a zillion questions, but we'll keep it to few because I know you guys are busy and we also want to get the audience in there. The word transformative was used by Dr. Nishtar. AI is transformative. Vaccines in the last century, Peter, were transformative. Penicillin was far away. Do you think AI can have an impact at scale in solving some of the biggest healthcare challenges in this century, especially for the low middle income countries? And what will it take?
I think AI can have an impact at scale. And I think two areas where it's going to be incredibly powerful are one in diagnosing what health problem a person has. That is still a massive challenge in many environments, including high-income environments. And two, empowering people to actually get a stronger control of their own health and well-being. However, if you look at the history of some of the biomedical interventions that have saved tens of millions of lives and made such a big difference to life expectancy, they didn't do that automatically. It didn't just kind of happen. It took the creation of Gavi, the creation of the Global Fund, the rolling out of antiretroviral barrels, the rolling out of antibiotics, rolling out of vaccines. And the thing I think we need to think about is how do we make sure that the power of AI is brought to the very poorest, the most marginalized in the world? Because that is, you know, history would suggest that that is not going to just kind of happen of its own accord. It's going to take sort of acts of leadership and commitment to make that happen.
To make sure that the power of AI doesn't end up in a two-tiered society, one has AI, one doesn't have AI. But Peter, you're saying, with a fast, tremendous potential. Dr. Nishtar, you talked about some amazing things AI is already doing within your organization. You have your incredible CTO also here. One of the biggest challenges for vaccines is the last mile delivery of vaccines, you know, the availability of cold chains, et cetera, especially in lower middle income countries. Can AI help with something of that nature, Dr. Nishtar?
Yes, indeed. AI hasn't, I would go as far as saying that AI has a potential use case and application for everything. It's a question of discovering that. It's a question of applying that and institutionalizing it, testing it, taking it to scale. I mean, the maintenance of the cold chain is very critical for us, as you know. And we really innovated on the last mile. Remote temperature monitoring is one of the tools because in many areas we work without electricity. You know, I've just been to a country in the last week where the government grid provides 2 hours of electricity only. So how do you navigate the cold chain in such situations? We had to engineer solar-powered visas, solar-powered health facilities and invest in this. And of course, the Global Fund and government work very closely to invest in assistance in the countries in which we work. And of course, you layer this with AI and you definitely will come up with other solutions.
So potential solution exists. Both of you work across the world, especially in low middle income countries, and you both work with health data. What challenges and safety are you putting together to make sure that data is what use/abuse? Because that's a big question that keeps coming up. So would love to get your feedback from that. And then we'll also want to get some of our amazing audience in there.
I mean, I think the issues around data integrity, data protection, are very real. And I'm, in all honesty, I don't think we're on top of it. And this is particularly true when you're talking about populations that are criminalized, stigmatized, excluded from society in different ways. These people are obviously very sensitive about having their data put into some kind of engine that will make decisions. And we are going to be very, very thoughtful about the way we gather, protect, use data so that we minimize the risks of it being misused.
Yes.
But I mean, there are others in this conference who go, no, I just started what I would, but my impression as somebody who's dealing a lot with populations who are persecutive in many ways is that at the moment, we don't really have systems, particularly in low middle income countries, that really detect those that data and out of use.
Don't have a solution. Well, some in the audience hopefully are listening and come up with some solution. Dr. Nishtar, any feedback on something like, which is pretty important and relevant?
Well, clearly you have to have policies in place to ensure ethical use and to protect the privacy laws of the sovereign environment in which you're functioning. And then, of course, you have to step up your own capacity to comply with those stipulations. I agree with Peter. It's an uphill task.
I mean, I think at the moment, AI is better at getting rare protections than it is at building protection. And that's one of the things we do need to think about, because health is sensitive matter, and people's privacy is important. So how we navigate that is a collective challenge that I don't think there's a very easy immediate answer to.
Okay, well, we'll open it up for some questions. I still have many more, but let's have a democracy here. We know this gentleman, he's been raising his hand. If you can get him a microphone. Okay. Please introduce yourself before you ask.
Sure, yes. I'm Thierry Janser. I'm the PI Group to a nonprofit out of Florida. And first of all, I want to thank Gerber Fund and Diaby for the critically important work you're doing. We focus on using AI to lift the bottom of the pyramid. That's people making less than $5 a day. We have a pilot quorum in Zambia, a little ways off from Chipadza, Zambia. And, you know, you talked about vaccines. Well, the cost of that village is out of vaccine by now, and they need to fight on vaccines. And you mentioned the medical imaging, you know, the hospital there has a digital scanner, x-ray machine, and a CT scanner, but they don't have the radiologist. So I wanted to talk to you a bit about how do we get involved with Global Fund and Giving to kind of collaborate to get these things and get the work, the great work they're doing into the off-grid village, which has the dire needs right now.
I think we should have an offline conversation. Very much welcome your offer. And I think our interests are aligned. We have a common objective. We want to use AI to promote equity and for the use of the bottom at the pyramid. So we're very much welcome an offline conversation.
I think, say what you're true, but I think this comes to the practical challenge we face, which is that there has been massive disruption, as you no doubt know, to global health programs in many of the poorest countries in the world over the last few months. And there was a very practical bandwidth issue. A lot of people are kind of firefighting. And so getting people to think about what the next leap forward is, as opposed to how do I solve this media problem, it can be a real challenge. And that
is just something we're going to have to work through.
Great. Any other questions? While they're thinking about it, I had a question. And again, this is just me. There's a lot of drug resistance that is happening around the world. And both of you are probably at the front line. Does AI have some kind of a solution around this issue?
Or maybe I'm using AI as a magic wand. I don't.
Yeah, no, I mean, it does because, let me take malaria, for example. Malaria, we are seeing increasing resistance to the most commonly used amoxicillin-based drugs. So the first thing you have to do is understand where that resistance is occurring, which is a disease surveillance cards, which means you actually have to be doing the kind of diagnostics that enable you to detect resistance. And then you need to be able to do, you need to be able to build patterns. So you need to be able to say, where is this resistance occurring? How can I see it moving across, particularly the continent of Africa? The second thing you have to do is understand why it's occurring. What's happening in the genomic structure of the parasite that is producing resistance, and therefore what can we do about it in terms of different types of treatment solution? And we do have a new generation of treatments. Unfortunately, they're all more expensive than the current ones. But which ones you use depends on which type of resistance you're... So this is a problem where, you know, information, joining the dots, all the things that AI is good at, is absolutely critical. I would say, however, the other few things you need, though, is the money to be actually putting in place the systems to capture the data. And also you need people who know what to do with the data and know how to use the tools. But AI is definitely going to be part of how we deal with problems like resistance.
So you raise a very interesting point. If there was a question that said, where on the patients with antibiotic resistance, how does that correlate with the practices of clinicians in that area? Where are the suppliers coming from, and are they substandard and have less active pharmaceutical ingredient? Now, 30 years ago when I was a student, and this research question had come to me, you would have designed a study. You would have collected longitudinal data over several years. And you would have looked at survey statistics. And you would have collected qualitative information from the manufacturer. And 5 years down the line, you would have published a research paper in The Lancet for which you would get academic kudos. But the time for action would have fired gone. And I think the change today is that you can get the answer to that in nanoseconds. And I think that is a transformation which at least I have seen in my lifetime and my profession career. That's profound. That's profound beyond our wildest imagination. But where is the challenge? My experience of having institutionalized, however you define AI within Gabia, you need money to do it. You need money, you need expertise, you need skills, you need licenses. You need to speak to those boutique innovators who have the little solutions. And I'll give you an example. When we came up with the paper of the Gavi 8 transformation, and because AI was one of the five pillars, I said, but we must use an AI engine to disseminate it, which we did. But Laura had to bend backwards to get the licenses, and every day we would look at how much it cost. So the costs are prohibitive. Let's not downplay that. And which is why I was so energized to hear colleague Jerry talk about his AI for food initiative. I think the actual truth, the pudding of these technologies would be their ability to improve the lives of those who work there. And since that means looking at a whole host of things that are cutting through barriers.
There is a risk. I think there is a real risk of it increasing inequity if we don't make a deliberate effort for it to do the opposite. And I'm particularly concerned about environments where very little of the information is captured in a digital form. Because AI is very good at, you know, exploring the world, the digital world, and bringing and synthesizing all the information. However, if that information isn't in digital form, if it's your community health worker with paper records, or then that's kind of lost. And unless we fix that fundamental thing of actually capturing the information in digital form, in a way those people, those communities, will be kind of left behind by all this.
But then, Peter, just to follow up, that AI is trained on data that is 70% English, Western educated or oriented.
You guys work in low middle income countries. How does that kind of translate? I mean, you talk about there's already a built-in inequity right there.
Yeah, there's a whole bunch of inequities. Language, huge inequity. Access to the internet, huge inequity. The skill sets to actually have people who could work out, help frame the questions in a way that will get the kind of answers that will produce useful things. There is also a sort of, how would I put it? What we don't want to be doing is kind of fine-tuning something where in some places the answer is obvious. If there isn't access to malaria medicine in a place with high burden malaria, if the children who get infected don't get diagnosed and treated within 72 hours, the chances of them dying rises pretty high. I actually do need a very sophisticated tool to tell me that if I'm in a high burden area and that we've got stockouts of malaria medicines, the immediate problem to fix is getting the malaria medicine set. So what we need to make sure is that we're using AI in the places where the information and analytical power really adds value. And we're not kind of doing it kind of for fun in places where actually we know what the answer is.
So it's a question of kind of money and execution. We need to get out there.
If I can comment on the question, like your question about, you know, the bulk of AI being in English language, you know, I'm not too worried about that. Because if we make the technology of failover affordable and available at scale, the market will correct for that. I'll give you the example of cell phones. I come from Pakistan. There isn't a single household where there isn't a cell phone. And I can tell you that with a lot of authority and humility, because I was a minister of social protection and I was on the ground all the time. Every household has access to a cell phone, either a cell phone or access to a cell phone. And of course, that accessibility, that scale has burgeoned the whole industry of translations of that, of services in vernacular. And I think in AI, this accessibility has to be there. If cost continues to be the barrier in ways that it is today, we're not going to be able to address the secondary challenges. So the English issue, AI, it's very much a secondary issue. We need to make it accessible to people. That people are fast learners. There are illiterate women in my country and in many in Africa that I have seen who have not what the cell phone is about. They just know the red button and the theme button, and that's enough for their usage. But we need to make this technology available, affordable, at scale, and the rest of the things we can make for us.
Just to follow you, I agree entirely. I don't think language is going to be the biggest issue because AI is very good at translation. And I think power structures are going to be a real problem. If you look at the medical profession and confession, I'm an economist and banker by background. Sanya's the real medic. But if you look at medical, it's very hierarchical. And there are lots of rules about who could do what. If you're a patient, you're allowed to do X, Y, and Z, but you can't do these things. If you are a nurse, you can do these things. If you're a midwife, you can do these things. If you're a junior doctor, you can do these things. If you're a specialist, you can do these things. Actually, AI is like an earthquake blowing up all that. It actually puts power into the hands of patients who access information and algorithms that tell them what they should do or should not do. It means that a nurse can do things that previously only a doctor. But I can tell you, in every single country in which we operate in, and indeed most of the rich countries as well, there is massive resistance to making those changes, because those rules also enshrine power structures, income differentiation. There's a lot riding on the way the structures of health workforces work. And I think that's going to be one of the biggest kind of battlegrounds of the... It's also a huge prize. It's a massive prize, because ultimately it puts power into the hands of all of us, right? It enables us to look after our health better. But again, I don't think it's going to happen automatically. It's going to require leadership and ability to take quite courageous decisions around, you know, what sound like boring matters, around task shifting that enable people who previously were owned by community health workers. We're funding hundreds of thousands of community health workers across Africa. In principle, at least, we could empower them with tools that would enable them to do much more than they could do.
Well, I could go on and on, but I'm getting the hook. But these are the folks who are the front line saving lives. Please give a big round of applause to Dr. Sagar Iparaki.
Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.